This the remix.
For Anderson and up the wall. Byfield tipped it. Moving in. Shot. Score! Andre Kopitar! Overtime winner! Game two! The series is tied at one!
Back of the net. Samsonov's lost his stick. Marchand shoots. He scores! Brad Marchand! Only Cam Neely has scored more playoff goals than that guy. He makes it 3-2 Bruins.
You're listening to The Press Box on ESPN Las Vegas.
Adam Candy from Legal Sports Report is in today for Ed Graney, who is traveling back from Dallas after the Golden Knights took the first two games of the series. Every other series in the West is 1-1 after the Kings beat Edmonton in overtime last night. Nashville and Colorado also won their game twos on the road. So the Golden Knights are the only Western Conference team with that 2-0 lead, and they happen to be coming home for games 3 and 4. Danny, I did some research for you. Yesterday, you told us that you bet on Chandler Stephenson to score a goal on his birthday, which was game one, and he did not score a goal. So I've got some information for you. First off, upcoming birthdays during the playoffs. There's only three possible outcomes here, and one of them's a goalie. Aiden Hill's birthday is May 11th. I don't know if you can bet on a goalie to have a shutout or something.
He
might not even be in the lineup, so that might be useless for you. But then May 13th, there are two birthdays. Michael Amadio and Mark Stone. Now, round one is scheduled. Game seven, if the Golden Knights and Stars went there, would be May 5th. So they're going to have to advance out of the first round and then have the schedule line up for that to even be a possibility, to bet on Stone or Amadio to score on their birthday. But those are going to be your only two options. However, the research I did, the Golden Knights used 34 skaters this year. You want to guess how many scored on their birthday?
Zero.
No Golden Knight player scored on their birthday this season.
But how many of those players have birthdays during the season?
Oh, damn near all of them.
Regular season.
Damn near all of them.
Really?
It was only three guys, Mantha and I'm blanking on the other two, that have like off-season birthdays. So most of the players' birthdays are during the season. Now, only eight of them actually had a game on their birthday.
Okay.
The majority of guys did not play on their birthday, but only eight had one game on their birthday, and one of those was Tomas Hertl when he played with the Sharks.
Did he score in that game?
He did not. No, none of them scored. That would have been one at least, even though it was for a different team. But the seven Golden Knights that did play for the Golden Knights on their birthday, you actually had some good ones in here. Jack Eichel played on his birthday, didn't score. Jonathan Marchessault didn't score. Obviously Stephenson. You had Petrangelo, Whitecloud, Kolesar, and Cotter all play on their birthdays and not score. In fact, Jonathan Marchessault, his longest goal drought of the season, included his birthday.
What a bum. That's why he didn't get the record.
The opposite. It is. It absolutely is why he didn't get it. The only thing for you to cling on to is that there were a few guys who scored around their birthday. So, like, for example, Ivan Barbashev didn't play on his birthday, but he scored in the game before and the two games after.
Wow.
And it was his only three-game goal streak of the entire season. And then Will Carrier and Pavel Dorofeev didn't play on their birthdays, but they both scored the day after their birthday in a game. But that's all you've got to cling on to. So your idea of, oh, it's Stevenson's birthday, better bet on him, absolutely nothing to go on off of that. In fact, the guys usually suck a little bit more than usual when it's their birthday.
Well, we'll see come May 13th. It's going to be a great day.
They might not even play that day.
Oh, they're going to. Well, as you just mentioned, players can score around their birthday, so I might still have to look at them.
All right. If they play on May 14th, you might have a better chance of them scoring than May 13th.
Probably.
For Mark Stone and Michael. Well, we'll see. Mario might not even be in the lineup for that game either. You might have a backup goalie and a scratched winger.
We'll also have to see if they might be traveling on their birthdays, because that might throw a wrench in the plans.
Oh, your handicapping counts for if they're traveling on their birthday. Okay, very important there. All right, so Golden Knights are up 2-0 in this. I found one thing interesting after the game, and maybe this is somewhat a game state because the Stars were losing in the third period again. But if you look at the way each team has distributed their shifts in this game. We talked about a lot last year. We've talked about it already after two games. But the Golden Knights play everybody. And at 5-on-5 in game two, the sixth defenseman for Vegas took between 22 and 26 shifts. There was not a big drop-off from the most used defenseman and the least used defenseman. For Dallas, Lindell and Heiskanen took 29 shifts. Lundqvist took 13. That's a huge difference in the amount of shifts. If you look at the forwards, similar story. The 12 forwards for Vegas, the fewest shifts taken was 16, and the most was 19 at 5-on-5. For Dallas's forwards, fewest was 10, most was 22. Pete DeBoer is not playing all of his guys. There are guys that are getting left on the bench. That's not happening for Bruce Cassidy. He has been able to roll four lines, roll three pairs. Do the Golden Knights ultimately win this series and more beyond this first round because of their depth again? Is this the conversation we're having for the next month or two? Is that they just play everybody and that's different from what most teams do in the postseason?
It only becomes that if they continue to get leads, right? Again, it's something you can't do the same way when you're chasing the game. You cannot keep throwing your third and fourth line, your third pair out there the same way when you're trying to chase a goal or a two-goal deficit. So if the Golden Knights can continue to find themselves in close game situations or have the lead, then yeah, then they'll be fine to be able to do that. But when you have to start double shifting your top couple of lines because you need more offense, then it's not quite the same.
I wonder if that need for more offense comes and how Cassidy handles it, if it's one goal versus if it's like three or something like that. Because I feel like he might still throw his fourth line or his third pair on the ice with 10, 8, 7 minutes to go in the third period because that's what he's done. They did it last year to that extent too. And last night, the second goal, the game-winning goal for the Golden Knights, it came with the Golden Knights' fourth line on the ice against Dallas's second line. Last night, Dallas got their top two lines on the ice against Vegas's fourth line. Now, Pete DeBoer did change his lines in the third period, so it wasn't quite as clear-cut. This is the first line, this is the second line for the entirety of the game. But Joe Pavelski started on the top line. Nick Waugh last night played the most minutes he played against any opposition forward was Joe Pavelski. And second and third were Matt Duchene and Tyler Seguin, who are their second line there. Against that second line, the Golden Knights, when it was Waugh against Duchene and Seguin, allowed 0.02 expected goals. They allowed just one shot on goal and scored the goal that ultimately won the game. The Stars had a little bit more success when it was Pavelski against Waugh. It was 0.28 expected goals, and Vegas produced absolutely nothing. They had one shot that wasn't even on goal when they shared the ice, but 0.28 over the course of about 4 minutes. Golden Knights, if they can get away with that, they'll probably take that. The Dallas Stars had no offensive advantage throughout that entire game when they had their best players on the ice against Vegas's fourth line. And this idea, we talked about it at 7 o'clock. We're talking about it again here. Does Dallas get a lead? Like, they've gotten some chances. When do they do that? If they can't do it when the Golden Knights put their fourth line on the ice, if they're losing that battle because they're giving up a goal, they're not going to take the lead. That whole idea of what will the Golden Knights do when they're playing from behind? What will Dallas look like when they get a lead? I don't know if it'll happen, because if you're telling Dallas right now, their fourth line's on the ice, you've got your best players on the ice, and you're not winning, you're not creating goals in that scenario, you're not putting some distance there, I don't think they win if that keeps happening, and that's what's been happening through these two games.
All right, so let's get out of the weeds a bit on this and go back to talking about why the Golden Knights are in this situation, right? Because who else just came back from long-term IR? Will Carrier, right? Will Carrier wasn't with them for a lot of the season, and Will Carrier has been a fixture on the fourth line of this team from day one. That gives them a fourth line that is what coaches love to call an identity line, right? That makes the fourth line more dangerous because they've gotten him back. But you also don't have to move up at either of the guys you have with him on the fourth line because you have Mark Stone and Tomas Hertl both in the lineup, right? The Golden Knights are a different team in the playoffs. And as sophomoric as it is to talk about the idea of, well, it's because of long-term IR. Well, no, it's because of long-term IR. It's because Mark Stone has been able to come back each of the last 3 years. It's because of Tomáš Hertl. It's because of what they can do in terms of having a fuller lineup in the playoffs. So yeah, the depth matters, and maybe Bruce Cassidy treats it differently in the playoffs than he would during the regular season. That remains to be seen. We only have all the numbers you just gave are two games of sample size, so I'm not about to get too excited about any of them.
Big sample size. Come on, two games is more than one. That's twice as much sample size as we had yesterday. It's great. I'm going to go back into the weeds for you again. I know the Golden Knights are up 2-0 in this series. It's not like there's any reason to panic, but something Ken Bulkey at Senbin pointed this out during the regular season. I thought it was kind of interesting. The idea that William Karlsson doesn't play a lot at 5-on-5, and it's not because he doesn't get put on the ice for shifts. It comes down to how long he stays on the ice compared to his teammates, and Jack Eichel is one of the bigger culprits of it. But we saw it last night where Karlsson played 17 shifts at 5-on-5, and all of the Golden Knights centers played either 17 or 18 shifts at 5-on-5. There wasn't this big gap in that. However, Karlsson played the fewest 5-on-5 minutes of any forward last night. All of the guys on the fourth line played more than Karlsson, and all of his line mates played more than him at 5-on-5 last night. Karlsson had the lowest average shift time of 36 seconds for comparison. Eichel was at 48, and Tomáš Hertl was over 50. So we're talking every time they hit the ice, it's 12 more seconds for Eichel. That's why it adds up over the course of the game, even if they're playing the same amount of shifts. They're up 2-0. I know they're in great shape in this series. If they're going to win the Stanley Cup, do they need Karlsson to play more minutes? Does he need to be on the ice longer than he has been?
I think we might need to add a little context to that, because you keep talking about 5-on-5, but the Golden Knights don't have a lot of players who play both special teams units, right? I mean, we are talking about a guy in William Karlsson who sees significant penalty kill time and also is out there on the power play occasionally for them as well. So I do think you can add some context to the fact that that's a guy you might need to keep on shorter shifts because of the need that you have for him in other spots in the game. So no, I don't think he has to play more, because I think it's very smart when we think about basketball and how we talk about efficiency, that if you know in what sort of stretch a guy is most efficient, you use him in that stretch.
The penalty kill time last night, Karlsson and Eichel were together and played the exact same amount of time, but they were the two most used forwards. Karlsson was actually the third most used center on the power play last night. He only played 36 seconds on the power play. So he's getting used there, but it's not big. The reason that I wonder about Karlsson, and maybe this is part of the reason why he's good, is that he does keep his shifts shorter. Maybe there is a reason to that he's just more effective in a 36, 40-second shift, as opposed to you get into that 50-second shift range and all of a sudden you're more tired and you start getting beat up a little bit. But it is an interesting thing. But the good news for the Golden Knights, when Karlsson's not out there, it usually means Jack Eichel's out there or Tomáš Hertl's out there. It's not like, oh, Karlsson's not out there and we've got a bum that shouldn't be on the ice. It usually means that Eichel or Hertl's out there, and maybe they're extending themselves longer than you would truly like, but they still have a good player on the ice, or like we just talked about, the fourth line is out there playing perfectly well against whoever the hell Dallas puts out there. All right, coming up next here on ESPN Las Vegas, it's Bischoff's Briefs.
It's Bischoff's Briefs, brought to you by Paul Padilaw. It's not about the injury, it's about the recovery. Bischoff's Briefs.
Mr. Madison will go first. Mr. Gordon, choose the topic.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Reflections of society and literature.
Bischoff's Briefs.
At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought.
Bischoff's Briefs.
The NFL Draft first round gets started tonight. You can hear it over on our sister station, Raider Nation Radio. That is 9:20 a.m. Coverage starts at 5 p.m. Adam, let me start with a question here before I get into this story The Athletic had. In general, would you say NFL teams are bad at drafting?
That's such an impossible question to answer. Just give me your fancy boy stats, and then we'll talk about it.
All right. So there's a story of The Athletic that talked to a lot of people across the NFL, but was kind of focused on this research paper that was done back in 2005. And it was written by a guy, a professor of economics, who won a Nobel Prize. But it basically found that teams overestimate their ability to sort of decide who's going to be good, who's going to be bad, and everywhere in between. We obviously saw a lot of that with the Raiders here. They also found, in terms of looking across the NFL, the probability that a player is better than the next player taken isn't very large. They just did it by which player starts more games in the NFL, and it's just a 53% probability that pick one starts more than two, two starts more than three, three starts more than four across the entire draft. And the number one pick in the draft is one of the least valuable picks in the draft based on the surplus value a team can get by trading that pick, because trading back, just on a pure value standpoint, is the most valuable thing an NFL team can do in the draft, because teams aren't good at identifying who's good and who's bad, and because there's not a big difference between one pick and the other, having more assets is generally a better idea, a better thing to have, because you're not smarter than everybody else. So if you get three shots at it and another team gets one shot at it, even if they're picking 10 spots higher than your best pick, you're probably going to have a better chance at producing players in the NFL, good players in the NFL. And there were two quotes that I think stuck out to me. One was from a longtime NFL exec who said, "I think the industry is relatively aware of this research on the draft, but I don't think there have been a lot of people willing to say, I'm going to fully invest in doing this differently than it's always been done." Another quote: "I don't think the research was suggesting any of this is an absolute, but it's just once you run into the realities of it, it's there. There is absolutely a bias against or fear of admitting uncertainty and trading back time and time again." And this is what I find interesting about the draft, because it's not a game where there's technically a defense against you and you're trying to figure things out on the fly. You can go into a draft with a general strategy and philosophy to say what's going to bring us the most quote-unquote value, and it can be trading back, and it can be understanding that we don't know more than anybody else. We shouldn't be super high on a player that nobody else is, and applying those. But what I find interesting is why teams don't do it, and I think it oftentimes comes from you have people in charge that it doesn't matter to them what the long-term better value is, because the idea of what's valuable in the draft is something that will play out over the course of 5 straight drafts, 10 straight drafts, 20 straight drafts, and often you don't have GMs or head coaches or whoever's making the decision. They don't have that time. They don't have the time to sit back and say, all right, well, if we do this in 15 straight drafts, we're going to be better at drafting than everybody else, because they're not going to be there for 15 straight drafts in most cases. And that's one of the things I find interesting in the NFL is who's making the decisions, and are they making them because it's good for the organization, or because, oh, I need to save my job. I need to do something that makes me look better, because if we're bad this year, I'm not going to be around to pay off the value that we'll get over time in trading back or whatever strategy we implement in the draft.
So basically, you just said a lot of things that still come back to nobody really knows, right? In the end, nobody really truly knows. And what that means is your organizational philosophy can't be about, well, we just take the best player on the board. Right? It has to be so much broader than that. We're going to get back into talking about analytics and information here and having a philosophy about what brings you the most value. What does, as an organization, how do we evaluate ourselves? And that's so key, right, Raiders fans? Right? And then how do you look at how to deal with that particular time in your life cycle as an organization? Because the Raiders have been constantly trying to find a way to keep swimming at 8 or 9 wins and hope that a couple games break their way so they get into the playoffs and they get to say just how close they were to beating the AFC champions when Derek Carr got intercepted in the end zone at the end of the Cincinnati game. But if you have a philosophy that says, you know what? We need to be honest. We're not that close right now, right? So what do you do during your life cycle when you're not that close? When you're not that close, what you do is that you gather as many shots at getting it right as is possible. If the draft is an inexact science, then take as many shots at being right as is possible, knowing that sometimes you're going to be wrong, right? You talked about the uncertainty and the fear of being wrong. Guess what? You're going to be wrong. Everyone is wrong about the draft any number of times. But if you're right at least half the time, you've done it better than most.
I think the Raiders are going to run into a problem with what they currently have set up. You and I have talked a lot about the Mark Davis effect on this and the idea that they're not going to tank under Mark Davis, and he is desperate for that 9-8 in the playoff season. Like, that is the Super Bowl to Mark Davis, and the idea of winning two games on purpose, or, you know, hey, we're not going to try that hard this season, just is not something that Mark Davis would seem to approve of. But then you throw into the two guys that they have, and Antonio Pierce and Tom Telesco, that are presumably the most important voices for making these decisions. Antonio Pierce, loud, boisterous, we're going to win now, we're going to have the Mahomes rules and all that. He very clearly is not the coach you hire if the plan is let's take a few years to really build this up. We might be bad for two of them, but we need the assets and all of that. That's not the guy you hire to do that. He's going to be thinking, we're winning as many games as we possibly can right now, no matter what. And then Telesco, who has come out and said, we're drafting the future, we care about what these guys are 3 and 4 years from now, not just what they are in this upcoming season. That's a fun thing, a good thing to say, but the history of Tom Telesco, there's not trading back early. And so the idea of, hey, can we accumulate the assets? Can we look at 2025 and 6 and 7 and say, how many players can we get that could be on their rookie contracts, that could be starting quality or better? Telesco hasn't done that in his career to say, let's trade back, let's get more assets. So it's not the most optimistic outlook for the Raiders actually getting out of this 8-win purgatory that they tend to find themselves in. The one last thing I did want to say on this, because the idea of trading back and the value and all of that, and the one quote about, like, people are aware of it, but are they willing to do it? And there's not really these absolutes about how you should handle it. You do have to pick players eventually. Like, in theory, yes, trading back is, that's great, but eventually you do have to use the picks themselves don't do anything. You've got to get players with those picks, and there are situations, and I think the Bears are in a perfect one right here, where you could look at it from a philosophy standpoint and say, the number one pick in the draft isn't that valuable unless you trade it because of all the extra assets you get. The Bears should be taking Caleb Williams. Like, there are absolutely teams who should just be taking players, even if there are the theory, the value of trading back. Caleb Williams, take him at number one, get your franchise quarterback, and hope that that's the guy that gives you a decade of contention, which is what he could be. All right, coming up next here on ESPN Las Vegas, J.R. Starkus joins the show.
This has been Bischoff's Briefs, brought to you by Paul Padilaw. It's not about the injury. It's about the recovery.
Hi, barkeep. How much for beer?
It's gross.
Ooh, that sounds expensive.
Can you give us a moment?
You don't know how to drink, your whole generation.
You drink for the wrong reasons.
My generation, we drink because it's good.
Because it feels better than unbuttoning your collar.
Because we deserve it. We drink because it's what men do.
It's never too early for him to mix up some drinks, even if it is only 9 in the morning. Find out what's on tap with extreme mixologist J.R. Starkus. Follow him on Instagram at J.R. Makes Drinks.
Southern Glazers Wine, Spirits, and Beer of Nevada. J.R. Starkus is here. Ed's not here. We're now into the year where Ed runs away from you.
Yeah, that's that time of year. So this is when I should start coming out with all the ice cream and frozen
yes,
and sweet drinks.
Because absolutely.
As long as Ed's not drinking them.
I'm pretty sure unless the Golden Knights sweep, they're going back to Dallas for Game 5. I'm pretty sure Ed will be out next Thursday as well.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely some Frappuccino-y coffee, some sort of caramelly, slushy drink for next week then, I think, is probably the way to go.
It'll be fun.
Yeah, live in studio, too. We should do something where you guys get to actually taste it again.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Just ice cream.
Just out of curiosity, off the top of your head, could you come up with some sort of like frozen caramel drink off 100%. The top of your head?
Yes. What do you want to be with? What's the
I don't know. I just was curious.
What's your favorite spirit?
Is this for you liking caramel, Danny?
Well, no, because he just mentioned caramel frozen drinks.
Yes. So what's your favorite?
I'm a bourbon drinker.
Great. So it would be bourbon, probably some like vanilla, maybe even like a Rocky Road kind of ice cream, right? Take a little bit of like a caramel sauce. No acid to this, no lemon or lime, but then maybe add a little bit of like a Mr. Black, like a coffee liqueur or a Bailey's or something like that. Flip it in a blender, pour it into a glass, maybe top it off a little whipped cream that Ed loves.
You got me.
Shaves chocolate over the top. Oof. Caramel drizzle. It's like a boozy shake, man.
To be fair, everything gets Danny.
Listen.
Like anything.
It sounds like his coffee that he drank this morning is what it sounds like.
I have a, I won't say bad, but my memory's not the best. So if you want to text me those ingredients, I'll make that drink and I'll send you a picture of it, show you what it looks like.
Fair enough.
I don't know if I'll do the shaved chocolate on top, but I'll see what I can do.
Can you do it to the group text so Ed can see it?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Yeah.
This is good. if you, JR, if you were doing the 999 challenge, mm-hmm. 9 beers, 9 hot dogs, and 9 innings,
yes.
What would your beer be?
Modelo.
Modelo?
Yes.
All right.
Not a bad choice.
Yeah, I like Modelo. I like Modelo, and like, I can drink. I'm not going to say like some people are like, oh, I drink all these Modelos, but I just feel like when I drink a pint of Modelo, it goes down so easy. So that would be my choice because I was in Washington a couple weeks ago to watch JT play. And before one of the games, my wife and I went to lunch and we went to a Mexican spot up there and I ordered a Modelo. And before like halfway through the chips, before my even entree came, I was done with the first one. And I was like, oh gosh, I need another one already. You know? So then I have to I start telling myself like, hey, be careful, like you're driving, like, you know. And I'm like, all right, so they go down really easy. Yeah, Modelo.
Danny is supposedly doing this in May.
Yep.
All right, at an Aviators game.
Okay.
Do you know what you're going to be drinking, Danny?
I do not. I'm hoping to probably just stick to a light beer, Bud Light or Coors Light.
Mm-hmm. Corona Premier or something like that would be like super easy to drink too.
I'm hoping it's also not too hot because that'll ruin it.
Have you been outside the last few days? It's going to be 110 in May, Danny.
Yeah, I know.
What day are you going? Do you know?
The 17th. They're playing El Paso.
Do you know where you're sitting? I'm going to try and go to that game.
I do not know where I'm sitting.
I would like to live stream.
I will talk to you after this.
No. Okay. Yeah. Good. Yeah. I would love to be able to be there with you and just take I want to take a before and every inning photo, and as the sweats start to come out more and in the seventh inning when it's dripping and your belly is just bloated from the seventh hot dog and you got two more in your lap ready to go. And
yeah, we're doing something with the Aviators, but not everything is 100% together. We're still working on things, finalizing details and stuff. And then once everything's finalized, we're going to make the official announcement on the
show. So I feel like you're already backing out. I feel like that's what's happening.
Oh, no.
He's in. Yeah.
No. It's me and
Sales is involved.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so what happens, all right, you get to the fifth inning and you have your fifth beer and your fifth hot dog and you're like, I am way full and I'm wasted and it's a problem now. And then maybe the Tourette's kicks in and something. What happens at this point? Do they cut you off or they let you keep going?
It's set up by Sales. He's got no choice.
When we were talking to people, they said, we'll supply you with a bucket. Let's have some fun.
My numbers, I'll be the sportsbook for this. I think 8.5 is going to be the number on the beer.
Okay.
So basically just do you get to 9 or not for the beer. Hot dogs, I'm thinking 5.5.
See, here's the number. Here's the secret to the beer piece of it, though. When it's that warm outside, you need to bring a beer koozie or something. The beer needs to be cold.
Oh, I'll bring a koozie.
Yeah. Because if you're not drinking it fast enough and that beer gets warm,
oh,
then
yeah.
It becomes a problem, right? Because lukewarm hot dog meat and warm beer is not a good combination.
I'm a koozie collector.
Oh yeah. Oh, have you heard about this?
No.
I have a drawer in my nightstand. The only thing in the drawer is koozies.
Nightstand.
And
ready
so,
to go. You don't know when you need them at 3:30 in the morning. Yeah.
So I gotta look through it, see if I have an Aviator's koozie. If not, I'll probably just get one the day of the game.
Do you have a favorite koozie?
I do. I do. I have two of them. Uh-huh. So one of them is the Golden Girls.
Okay.
And then the other one is a, I forget who it is.
What?
I know. It's terrible. It's a famous actor. He's still acting, but like his heyday was like the 70s and 80s.
Tony Danza.
No. Mm. It's the picture. It was a joke thing. My buddy used to get me four every year, and he got me these ones with the Golden Girls. And then it's the picture of him like laying down in front of a fireplace. I forget who it is.
You don't even know what it is. It's your favorite. And you don't even know what it is.
It's my favorite because it's funny. I'll take a picture of it when I get home today.
What's your favorite meal? It's that thing that I like so much.
I think it's chicken, but it might be steak. I don't really know.
But my Golden Girls is the top one. I use that all the time. And I have a different one for every holiday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Danny's a disaster over here. But yeah, I'm going 8.5 for beer, 5.5 for hot dogs.
I have one. I might use it today. Oh, no, I'm working for the draft. I was going to say I have a koozie. It's made out of turf on the outside.
Hold on. Do you know what size of the beer it is?
Did you just do 12?
Well, yeah, but I mean, sometimes
I don't think they serve 12 at the ballpark. I think it's 16s.
Oh, boy.
And I did the math.
16s and 24s.
I did the math.
24s. So unless you have like 1 24 counts as two, but you better keep that thing cold.
I did the math. If I do the 16 ounces, if I do all nine, that actually equates to 12 12-ounce beers.
Might need to bump my line down a little bit.
Definitely going down. Yeah, it's all right. not happening.
You guys don't have faith? Come on.
What are you making for us, JR?
I cannot wait to be there. You will not be drinking nine of these in nine innings, that's for sure. So I went to the grocery store the other day and just doing some shopping, and I wasn't even really thinking about this week's drink, but I love pineapple, and so I grabbed a pineapple, and then just on the end cap was some, like they had like a sale on like these jalapenos, and I was like, oh, pineapple and jalapeno, that's this week's drink, I'm gonna do something with that, right? That's literally how it worked out. So I wanted to do something that was super simple with some fresh ingredients. So being that you're gonna see, you know, pineapple more in the store now, it's becoming fresh, summertime, warmer weather, this drink is really very easy to make. So cube up some pineapple. I put about 4 to 5 cubes of pineapple, and the more – you can actually add as much pineapple to this as you wish. Just remember, the more pineapple you add, one, there's more displacement in the glass, but two, the drink becomes a little bit sweeter, okay? And then I sliced up some jalapeno, like dime size, and I added 3 pieces of jalapeno into my mixing tin. Again, same thing with the jalapeno. If you want it spicier, add more. If there are seeds in the jalapeno, it becomes spicier, right? So you can adjust this as much as you want. This would be a little more difficult to make in a restaurant setting, perhaps, because this style of making a drink creates naturally inconsistencies, right? How big is the pineapple? How juicy is the pineapple? How spicy is the jalapeno? So this is a great drink to do at home. So 4 pieces of pineapple, 3 slices of jalapeno, 3/4 ounces of fresh lime juice, and 1/2 ounce of agave nectar right into your mixing tin, okay? All those ingredients, just muddle them together, right? Then, once it's muddled together, you're going to add 2 ounces of an aged rum. I added Mount Gay Eclipse rum. Now it's known as Mount Gay Heritage Blend rum. Same juice, different package. So for my friends that work for Remy Cointreau, that we're going to see this photo in this video later, and they're going to bust my chops about using the old bottle. The juice is still good, and it's still delicious, but Mount Gay Eclipse, Mount Gay Heritage Rum, 2 ounces. There are no other modifiers in this drink whatsoever. It's literally just the rum, the pineapple, the jalapeno, the agave, and the lime. Take all those ingredients, fill it with ice, and shake the crap out of it. okay? Because this is going to be a shake and pour method. You're not going to strain over fresh ice like I do a lot of the time. You want the jalapeno and the pineapple in the drink, okay? So shake it well, strain it into or pour it into a large, like double old-fashioned or rocks glass. You need a vessel that is big enough because of the additional stuff in there with the pineapple. And if you don't have a big enough glass, it's just going to overflow. So make sure you have a glass that's big enough. And then I just garnished it with a slice of lime right on top. The drink is absolutely delicious. If you do it right, because you muddle the pineapple and that juice, when you shake it, there will be kind of that like little frothy, creamy head on top of the drink. And you will have this just nice balanced spice of jalapeno flavor with this juiciness of the pineapple and the overtones of the rum. And it's an absolutely glorious, easy to drink by the pool, warmer weather style cocktail that really is great for this time of year with all the fresh ingredients that are in the grocery store.
Would it fit in your unicorn cup?
Yes. Yeah, it would. I mean, it wouldn't really do it justice in the unicorn cup, though, because like part of the visualness of this is seeing the chunks of the pineapple and the jalapeno in the glass. So I think you're almost doing a disservice to the visualization of the drink if you pour it into the unicorn cup. But it would fit in the unicorn cup for sure.
The unicorn cup is the visualization, JR.
That it is too, but I mean, if that's the case, then don't do all the work of muddling all the other stuff. Like do another drink where you don't have to do all that extra work because you're doing that extra work for really nothing.
All right, JR. Ed probably won't be here next week.
That's okay.
So we can yell at him again.
I'll sit in the chair of front runner again. Yeah.
He's JR Starkus, Southern Glazer's Wine, Spirits, and Beer of Nevada. Coming up next, we'll wrap up the show.
Now, back to the Press Box on ESPN Las Vegas.
Big thanks to Adam Candy from Legal Sports Report for filling in for Ed Graney the last few days. Adam will be here again tomorrow. I won't be. So it'll be Adam and Ed tomorrow here on the Press Box. But Adam, during that break, Danny turned on the TV in here so we could hear some of SportsCenter's coverage of the NFL draft. And the anchor on SportsCenter said that the New York Giants, since 2015, have had 8 top 10 picks, and that's tied with the Jets for the most in that span. How the hell have they had so many top 10 picks?
Well, it's a complicated situation in which they have sucked more than they haven't.
But okay, you and I, obviously we've talked a lot about the Raiders. They're the team here. We do talk about the Giants a little bit, just for you. How many of those have actually been good players? Like Odell Beckham, is he one of those?
With the number 10 pick, like right at the very end. But how about taking Saquon Barkley, number 2? How about taking Daniel Jones, number 6? How about Evan Neal, who we're not ready to close the door on entirely yet, but looks pretty bad right now. Kayvon Thibodeau kind of starting to come around. Not great, not terrible. You know, I mean, Andrew Thomas is the stud out of that. Right, and that's a left tackle, and it hasn't been enough for that offensive line to be any good.
I've got it here. Odell was actually pick 12 in 2014.
Oh, my apologies.
So he doesn't even fit into this. Eric Flowers, Eli Apple, Saquon Barkley, Daniel Jones, Andrew Thomas, Evan Neal, Kayvon Thibodeau. Those are the top 10 picks the Giants have had.
All right. Eric Flowers was one of the biggest disasters in New York Giants history. Eli Apple was a total panic pick because the Giants were in a position where they thought they were going to be getting Leonard Floyd, and then Chicago traded up in front of them, one pick in front, and took Leonard Floyd, and they were like, oh, well, we weren't planning on having to do this, and then they took a terrible corner, which was a Raiders-esque, no one saw it coming pick.
That's always good when you can do a Raiders-esque type of pick. So how much confidence you have that they're not drafting 8 times in the top 10 over the next decade?
Dave Gettleman's no longer there, so my belief is that anything that isn't Dave Gettleman will be an improvement in terms of the GM for the Giants. Look, the Giants are in quarterback purgatory. They made a bad decision with Daniel Jones. They can get out of the contract for basically no money next year. They should make a smart decision when it comes to quarterback this year, which is one of two things. If an opportunity to trade up to get Drake May presents itself, you do it. You don't do it for anybody else. Beyond that, you just take the best receiver you can. And if Daniel Jones is any good, fine, then maybe they have a decent season. You're still getting rid of him next year. But if Daniel Jones is as bad as he was last year, then you'll be in position to take a quarterback again next year.
The other amazing part about that stat is that the Giants are only tied for the most top 10 picks since 2015, and they're tied with the New York Jets. You might be a little biased because you're a Giants fan, but do you think it's better or worse for the country as a whole if the Giants and Jets both suck for a decade straight?
Oh, it makes no difference with the Giants. It has to happen with the Jets, right? Like, no matter what you think of the New York Giants, there will never be a butt fumble in their history, right? There will never be anything as hilarious as what has happened to the New York Jets over the course of time. I mean, there's a reason that Jets and Mets fans are of one ilk in New York. You root for the Giants and the Yankees, or you root for the Jets and the Mets. And if you root for the Giants and the Yankees, yeah, it's also been a rough run here lately. But when it comes to rooting for the Mets and the Jets, you're just rooting for losers. You've been rooting for losers, with the exception of 1986, for your entire lifetime, unless you were old enough to see Joe Namath. So I feel bad. My dad's entire side of the family is Mets Jets. And I am just so grateful to my mother and my grandfather for saving me from that fate. My grandfather took me to my first Yankees game when I was 5 years old. And when the Yankees were horrible, I'll admit, there were a couple of years in there where I wavered. It was right around 86 when the Mets were good, and I wanted to be rooting for a winning team, and my cousins were rooting for a winning team. So I rooted for the Mets, but I came home, and everything's been fine since.
All right. I don't have apparently enough New York knowledge. Is it that stark? Like, is it truly Jets and Mets fans are all the same, or how many people are crossovers between those two?
It's the overwhelming minority. I was going to say minority, but it is an overwhelming minority. You are Yankees, Giants, or Mets, Jets without fail. Nobody is Nets, because that's a New Jersey team that's just squatting in Brooklyn. We're all Knicks fans come hell or high water. And, you know, then we could probably get back into what you accused me of earlier this week,
yeah,
which was of being a Rangers fan, which you might as well have told me that I can't even come up with anything. It's that insulting.
Why are you a Devils fan? Why does Rangers seems to fit the Giants Yankees?
It does. It actually,
okay,
it fits it perfectly. So when I was growing up, Rangers games were really super expensive, and you were hard to get tickets. And so my family had a restaurant outside of New York City, and the distributors knew that my mom was a single mom, and they wanted to kind of, you know, get in good favor, and so they'd give her tickets. Well, which tickets were they going to give her? They're not going to give her the Rangers tickets. They gave her the Devils tickets. Okay. So I grew up going to Devils games, and you know, the Devils in my lifetime have 3 Stanley Cups, and the Rangers have 1, and the Rangers can suck it until they don't suck it, which will be, I don't know, never in my mind. They can suck it forever. I hate the Rangers more than I hate the Red Sox.
Oh, wow. All right, Matt Rimpey, game-winning goal in Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final. I can't wait for it. That's going to be an exciting time in June. We'll kick Ed off the show just to bring you on for that. It's going to be phenomenal. All right,
it's a good thing I'm on tomorrow after the Giants screw up the draft.
It is. You are excited to yell for 3 hours about the Giants doing something hilariously bad in the first round tomorrow. Adam Candy and Ed Graney, they've got you tomorrow.